discuss false vacuum internal inflation. And to begin with, we need to figure out how tunneling occurs when we include gravity. So last time we saw how to find the decay rate per unit volume of a scalar field in a fixed Minkowski background. And so I'll just start out by telling you a bit about what changes when we couple the scalar field minimally to gravity. So last time, we studied tunneling when the action takes the form integral d4x. Pi squared minus v in real time. And today, I'm just going to include a minimal coupling to gravity. So what changes? So remember, we calculated the decay rate per unit volume by finding the solution to the Euclidean equations of motion, the classical solution to those equations. And that gave us the exponent of the decay rate per unit volume. So we basically want to do the same thing here. The big difference now is there's a lot more degrees of freedom in our theory. So in addition to a scalar field, we have a dynamical metric. So in general, there's a whole lot more degrees of freedom. All of the components of the metric. But if you remember, before, our solution was O4 symmetric. And there was a proof of that. We're going to make the assumption that the solution is O4 symmetric. And that's going to greatly reduce the number of degrees, number of independent functions we have to solve for. So this is an assumption. There's no proof that the lowest action solution to the Euclidean equations of motion is O4 symmetric, but no counterexamples have ever been found. And we wouldn't expect the solutions to break that symmetry. There's no reason that they should. So if we make this assumption, we can write the metric, the Euclidean metric, in terms of a single unknown function, which I'm going to call rho of xi. So there still are more degrees of freedom, but now we just need to find two functions instead of many. So we need to determine the classical solution for rho and phi.
That's how correct. Is this different from the regular FIW?
So here we're this is a Euclidean metric, so there's no minus signs anywhere. So if we go to Lorentzian signature, it'll be 0.331 symmetric. So it'll be maximally symmetric. So with this choice of metric, we can compute the action in terms of rho. And the result is just a 2 pi squared from the angular integration. Times integral over c, rho cubed y dot squared over 2 plus v, where here dot is c derivative. And the r term works out to be rho squared rho double dot. Plus rho, rho dot squared, minus rho. So this is just the Einstein-Hilbert term. Okay. So so that just comes from taking this metric and plugging in here. We can find the equations of motion by varying this action. Equation of motion for phi. And the result is very similar to the equation of motion we were studying at the end of last lecture. The difference is just that the time-dependent damping term takes a slightly different form. So last time, we had a different coefficient here. And we also need to look at the Einstein equation to determine rho. And if we look at the CC component of the Einstein equation, we find that rho dot squared is equal to 1 plus rho squared over 3m Planck squared. 1 half phi dot squared minus v. Okay. So these are the equations we want to solve. We want to find a classical solution for phi and rho. It will give us the dominant contribution to the tunneling rate per unit volume. And so we need boundary conditions. So this is the metric for a sphere. So at the poles of the sphere, rho should go to 0. And we just choose one of the poles to be at 0 and set rho of 0 to be 0. Now, this implies, by the Einstein equation, that if rho of 0 is 0, then phi dot of 0 has to be 1. And if we don't want this term to be singular, if at c equals 0, rho dot equals 1 and rho equals 0, then we need phi dot to be 0 at that point as well. So this implies by the equation of motion that phi dot of 0 equals 0. Okay. Now, we can show by taking a derivative of the Einstein equation and using the equation of motion, we can put the Einstein equation in a different form, write it as minus rho over 3m Planck squared y dot squared plus v. And let's restrict our attention to decay from a positive false vacuum to a positive true vacuum. So let's suppose our potential looks like this. So in that case, rho double dot is everywhere negative. So the solution for, because this term is positive and this term is positive. So the solution for rho as a function of xi will look something like this. Reach a maximum and then become zero at some maximum value of xi. So that's at the other pole of the metric. So that means we need to impose these same conditions at Cmax as well. So we're imposing more boundary conditions than we're allowed to. So there's not always a solution. So we need to fine-tune our initial conditions in order to get a solution. So if you remember yesterday, so when we were solving the equation of motion on the inverted potential, let's look at our inverted potential. So here we have phi false. Here we have phi true. And so yesterday we were looking for a solution that started, found that the solution to the Euclidean equation of motion started somewhere to the left of phi true and then ended up at phi false. So we have more initial conditions. So there in general won't be a solution that starts somewhere here and ends satisfying these conditions at Cmax when phi is equal to phi false. So the general solution, when they exist, will start somewhere in between phi true and the minimum of minus phi. Let's call that point phi 1 star. And we'll go to some point to the left of the minimum of minus v and to the right of phi false. And let's call that point phi 2 star. So when the solutions exist, it'll be a solution that goes from here to here. And so let's just sketch what that solution looks like. So we sketch phi versus xi, where this is Cmax. So the solution will start at phi 1 star at rest and go to phi 2 star with zero velocity. So it's something like this. And depending on the parameters of the potential, these solutions may or may not exist. So what's the physical interpretation of this? So solutions don't actually start in the false vacuum. They go, if we look at the tunneling, it's something like this. So we're tunneling not from phi false to phi true, but some other place over here. And so a nice interpretation of why the tunneling looks like this when we're tunneling from a de Sitter vacuum to a de Sitter vacuum was proposed by Brown and Weinberg, who explained this effect that the solutions start here as being a thermal fluctuation due to the Gibbons Hawking temperature of de Sitter space. And so they go through an alternative derivation where that gives you the same final tunneling rate per unit volume, but makes explicit the fact that you can think of this as a thermal effect. Okay. So once we have these solutions, we can find the decay rate per unit volume the same way we did yesterday. And so the formula we had yesterday was decay rate per unit volume is just e to the minus e over h bar. And here we see that there's one extra difference compared to what we saw yesterday. So before, B was just the Euclidean action of the instanton. So this is what we saw yesterday. So there's a difference today. So when we were dealing with tunneling without gravity, we were free to add an overall constant to our potential. For dealing with non-gravitational physics, the zero of the potential doesn't matter. So we always set phi false, the energy density at phi false, to be zero. We're no longer free to do that when we include gravity. Gravity does care about the absolute energy scale. So that means that the Euclidean action of a solution that just sits in the false vacuum for all time is not going to be zero when we, if the energy density in the false vacuum is not zero. So we need to subtract off the Euclidean action of the solution that just sits here. So if we're, so there's an extra term here, which is the Euclidean action of a solution that just sits at phi false. So this, we need to subtract off the background solution. And so this action is easy to evaluate. So we can find rho very easily from this equation. So if phi just sits at phi false, this term is zero, and we just get a sine. And so the result is if you plug the sine, you get rho is equal to a sine with the correct constants into the formula for the Euclidean action. You get that this action is minus 24 pi squared times m Planck to the fourth over the energy density in the false vacuum. So it's negative. And that comes from the fact that we have a negative in front of r. So that term always beats the positive rho squared v term. So this is negative. And if you work out what SE of phi I is, you can show that this is always negative 2. So you'll in your homework, you'll go through some examples of how to compute this. In general, it's complicated. And unless you're in the thin wall limit, you often need to solve these equations numerically. But this action will be negative. But the difference is still going to be positive, which is important because we derived our result assuming that the instantons were well separated. So if the the K rate per unit volume gets too large. We can't trust the approximation we made to derive that formula. And so we only expect this formula to make sense or to be valid if B is of order H bar or greater than H bar. So we need this to be less than 1 for the approximation to make sense. And fortunately, we usually have that the magnitude of the background Euclidean action is greater than the magnitude of the Euclidean action of the instanton solution. Okay. Now, what do these bubbles look like after they nucleate? So yesterday we saw that if we just have a bubble of a, if we're looking at tunneling in fixed Minkowski background, the bubbles after they nucleate rapidly in the thin wall limit, the speed of the bubble walls rapidly approaches the speed of light, and basically the same thing happens. When we include gravity, for in the thin wall limit, the bubble walls also rapidly approach the speed of light. So let's look at that a little more carefully and see what that implies. So in the flat slicing, write the De Sitter metric as in real time, minus dt squared plus a squared dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. And if I call r of t the co-moving co-moving position of a bubble wall that nucleates at t0, then if the bubble walls rapidly approach the speed of light, then we have that dt of this is approximately 1 over a, or e to the minus hft. Okay. Oh, and we'll assume it's centered at r equals 0. So we can solve this equation very easily and get that r t naught of t is approximately integral from t naught to t e to the minus hf t prime dt prime, which is 1 over hf e to the minus hf t naught minus e to the minus hf t, which at late times we can neglect this term and just get 1 over late times e to the minus hf t naught. So the co-moving size of these bubbles approaches a constant at late times. And the later the bubbles form, the smaller the asymptotic co-moving size of the bubbles is. So let's sketch a picture of what the space-time will look like. We have many of these bubbles. So here, just to be R and T. So if we have a bubble that forms at an early time, it will reach a large co-moving size at late times. So here, this distance here is 1 over the scale factor at the time when it nucleates times 1 over HF. And bubbles that nucleate at later times will reach a smaller asymptotic co-moving size. And later still will reach even smaller size. And we see from this picture that bubbles that form too far apart will never collide. So even though these bubble walls are expanding at the speed of light, they never intersect if they're too far apart at the time of nucleation. And so that means that if the background space-time is exponentially expanding, inside we can imagine that inside the bubbles, inflation ends. So here again, we have a random process for ending inflation. So like we saw on Wednesday, if inflation ending is a random process, and the probability for ending inflation is low enough, then we can get eternal inflation. So let's figure out what the critical nucleation rate per unit volume is in order to get eternal inflation. So when is inflation eternal in this picture? Okay. So to figure that out, let's introduce a quantity, FF, which is the fraction of the co-moving volume in the false vacuum. So I want to compute the time derivative of FF. We can write this as, so the fraction of co-moving volume in a false vacuum will decrease every time a bubble nucleates. So we can write this as minus the number of bubbles per four volume. Should be proportional to the volume in the false vacuum times the co-moving volume per bubble, which we just computed. Divided by the total co-moving volume, which may be infinite, but if we just look at a finite patch, we can make sense of this formula. So let's just look at a co-moving Hubble volume. That's its size 1 over HF, so minus 3. This is just the decay rate per unit volume that we've calculated, gamma over vol. The volume in F is equal to FF times the co-moving volume that we're looking at, which is HF to the minus 3. But here we want the physical volume, so we need to multiply by the scale factor cubed, 3 e to the 3 HFT. And the co-moving volume per bubble is, so we just calculated the co-moving radius of a bubble. And so it's just 4 pi thirds times the radius we just calculated cubed, which is HF to the minus 3 e to the minus 3 HFT. Okay. So can cancel off factors here. So these cancel. This cancels. And we're left with minus 4 pi thirds gamma over volume HF to the minus 3 times FF, which I can write as minus kappa TF FF, where this is just characterizes the transition rate between the false and true vacuum. So, solution to this, just an exponential function. FF is e to the minus kappa TF times T. And so, as we saw on Wednesday, the fraction of the co-moving volume in the false vacuum just decreases exponentially. But defining eternal inflation to be a exponential increase in the physical volume in the false vacuum. So the physical volume, BF, it should just be proportional to FF times the scale factor cubed, so e to the 3 HFT, which is e to the 3 HF minus kappa TF T. And so if we compare what kappa TF is to 3HF, that determines whether we have eternal inflation or not. So if the decay rate per unit volume is too large, then we'll get a decaying exponential here. But if this expansion term wins, then we have eternal inflation. And so if we just plug in our result for kappa TF, we see that the transition point is roughly when HF to the fourth becomes comparable to gamma over volume. So this is the transition rate to eternal inflation. So we need about one bubble per Hubble volume to prevent eternal inflation. And that's roughly where our approximation breaks down. So if if this calculation is under control, then this will typically be much, much less than HF to the fourth. Okay. So what does the space-time look like if we have eternal inflation? So far we've just been concentrating on decay from one vacuum to another vacuum. In principle, we could have many, many vacua. So our potential could be more complicated, and we could have several vacua, some of which could be have zero vacuum energy or even negative vacuum energy. So let's call these different, give these different vacua names. Let's call these, one is, let's say, is the highest energy, two, three, and four. So if we sketch a Penrose diagram of what space-time will look like, and so it will depend on what our boundary conditions are at minus infinity. So let's suppose we start in vacuum one. And so we can have transitions between all the different vacua. And we'll get bubbles of different types. So we can imagine we nucleate a bubble of type 3, inside of which nucleates a bubble of vacuum 4. We could have another bubble of vacuum 3 over here, additional bubbles of, say, vacuum 2, kind of a direct transition to vacuum 4. And so the space-time at late times is very complicated. And in fact, it's been shown that you get a fractal distribution at late times, space-time. And so I haven't discussed what happens, what the inside of each a bubble will look like to an observer inside the who lives inside the bubble. So it can be shown based on the symmetry of the bubble that the inside of each bubble is an open, an infinite open FRW universe. Where past infinity corresponds to the nucleation event. The bubble wall lives at t equals minus infinity. And we also get, in the space-time, an infinite number of bubbles as t goes to infinity. So,
someone's got to challenge that. Like the most remarkable thing
of all of this. Okay. So, comment on this fact that there's an open FRW universe inside of each bubble. So, that's basically the reason why, at the beginning of lecture on Wednesday, I sketched a potential that looks like this. So we need if bubble nucleated in our past and we live inside such a bubble, we need slow roll inflation after nucleation. In order to dilute the curvature. So this bubble nucleation was the original proposal for how inflation ended, but it doesn't work for this region. It's because you end up with a curvature-dominated universe after the nucleation of the bubble. Okay, so we have this picture of an infinite number of bubbles, infinite spacetimes, infinite volume of spacetime. So this makes making predictions a challenging task. And why is that? It's basically because if we have an eternally inflating universe, we have an infinite volume of space-time for events to occur, and so any event that can happen will happen an infinite number of times. So how do we make predictions if everything that can happen, will happen? Okay. So, usually, we say that the relative probability of two events occurring should be equal to the number of events of type A that occur divided by the number of events of type B that occur if we repeat an experiment that has A and B as possible outcomes many times. So this is this works in everyday circumstances, but this definition becomes problematic if both A and B are infinity. So let's see why that is by looking at a simple example. So what is the ratio of even, my notes are odd to even integers. Okay. Seems like a well-defined question. If we use this prescription, and we order the integers in the usual way, then the probability that an integer selected from the first n integers is odd, is the floor function of n plus 1 over 2. And probably that it's even, or the number that are even in the first n is at the floor of n plus 1 over 2. And the number of even integers in the first n integers ordered in this way is the floor of n over 2. So if we define PA over PB to be the limit as n goes to infinity of the ratio of the number of odd integers in the first n integers divided by the number of even integers in the first n integers. We get one half. Okay, so no surprises there. Yes. Well, so we haven't, as we go, take the limit that t goes to infinity in a universe that has eternal inflation, the volume of the universe at late times goes to infinity, too. So we have an infinite time and an infinite amount of space for things to happen. So if something is allowed to happen, then just based on the fact that we're doing, we can do an infinite number of experiments in such a universe. So we expect that if the outcomes are random, we'll get all possible outcomes. Eventually.
I think you want that to be one.
One, yes. One. Yeah. Okay. But we can also choose to order the integers in a different way. So let's suppose we put two odd integers before every even integer. We're still counting all of the positive integers will be on our list. Positive. Repeat the same calculation. We get the floor of 2n plus 2. It's the number of odd integers in the first n. And the number of even integers in the first n is n over 3. The floor of that. So that tells us then that PA over PB is the limit as n goes to infinity of 2n plus 2 over 3 over n over 3, which gives us 2. So we get two different answers depending on how we order things. So another way of saying this is that our answer depends on the way we regularize this, so the way we take the limit that n goes to infinity, or depends on the measure. So these are equivalent statements. In this case, for this particular question, you can argue that we have a preferred measure, a preferred ordering equivalently, and that this should be the correct answer. So if we do have a preferred measure or preferred ordering, in a universe with eternal inflation, a way we can define probabilities like this, then it's not necessarily a problem. But in fact, there are Let's look at an example of one measure that was one of the first proposed that may seem like a unique way or the most natural way to count events in eternal inflation. And so this is called proper time cutoff. Okay. So this is a proposal for how to order events in eternal inflation. And so the proposal goes that we begin with a finite space-like surface, finite initial surface, and t equals 0, and count all events that occur before a cutoff time, tc, and then take tc to infinity. So what happens if we do this? So let's suppose that in an initial surface, the universe is in a false vacuum that's expanding very rapidly. And just to put some numbers to it, let's suppose that in the initial vacuum, the expansion rate is, say, 10 to the Hubble constant, inverse Hubble constant is, say, 10 to the minus 40 seconds. So this means that every second, the volume of the universe, volume of space, grows by a factor of 10 to the 40. Yes. Yes. So this measure is problematic. It's not always. Can't always define this uniquely, but there's problems even if you could. I'm not trying to defend this measure. I was going to point out a problem, a different problem with this, but yes, that is another problem with this measure. Okay, so if this means that the volume is growing by a factor of 10 to the 40 every second. So you can imagine, our universe is about 13.8 billion years old, measured from our local Big Bang. So the local Big Bang is when the bubble would nucleate. Inside a bubble, we can describe it as an infinite FRW universe. And so according to this measure, universes that are 1 second younger than ours, measured relative to the local Big Bang, spent one additional second in the false vacuum. So those should outnumber our own, ones that have the same age as our own, by a factor of 10 to the 40. So if you use this measure, this leads to what's known as the youngness paradox, which, according to this measure, basically our universe should be as young as possible, where possible is, I won't define possible. There's arguments over that, but The question is, if this is the unique measure, it seems to contradict experiments because there's nothing in our experience that tells us our universe is as young as it possibly could have been. So this measure is problematic, and in fact, there's no agreed upon measure. So there's no agreed upon method for assigning probabilities in a eternally inflating universe. Okay. So I just want to close with a few final thoughts and questions. So this is an active area of research, and Lots of things we don't understand about internal inflation. So one interesting question is there any way to get observational evidence for internal inflation? And one possibility is bubble collisions. So it's possible that in this picture up here, a bubble nucleated close enough to our own bubble and collided with our own bubble, assuming we're living in such a bubble. And it could leave imprints on the CMB. And so Matt is the expert on this. And you can ask him about searches for signals of bubble collisions in the early universe. So second, I've outlined a number of conditions that need to be satisfied for eternal inflation to occur. So we don't know what the potential looks like. We don't know what the initial conditions are. We can design potentials that don't have eternal inflation. And so this is an open question. So do we have a universe that does the potential ever support stochastic eternal inflation? And crucial ingredient for false vacuum eternal inflation is that we have vacua that have a long enough lifetime. The decay rate is too quick, then there's no false vacuum. Eternal inflation. And so it's possible if there's, for instance, a large number of fields, it could be a large number of decay routes that could lead to tunneling that's fast enough to prevent internal inflation. Or if there's many vacua, there could be interference, quantum interference between tunneling paths that could lead to faster tunneling. So. Open question whether or not conditions for eternal inflation are satisfied, although it doesn't seem easy to avoid it. Finally, if this whole picture makes sense, and we do live in an eternally inflating universe, it's still inflating in some other space-like regions. Crucial question is, what is the proper measure? Is there a unique or preferred measure? So if we do live in eternally inflating universe, we can't make predictions if we don't understand the answer to this question. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Let's thank Dan. I don't have a t-shirt for that, but I do bestow time and thanks and the praises I'm giving to those excellent lectures.
Thank you.
If anyone wants to celebrate the end of the class by going down to the bistro and I will buy you a cake, please join me.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, you can ask questions about crazy stuff like this. Finally, you caught on in the end.
Infinite, what is this?
There's an infinite number of things that happen an infinite number of times. You caught on to how crazy the statement was.